Good afternoon, everyone. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and thank you to Peter Eggleton for actually inviting me to come and talk on the subject of sexual and gender diversity among youth. And I'm talking from a health sector response angle. So I myself am a doctor, and so it's perhaps going to be a slightly different angle than the previous speakers. So thank you. We all know, I don't need to tell any of you here about health status compared to young people generally. We know that there are additional barriers to sexual and reproductive health care. We know that there are poorer well-being, mental health and physical health outcomes. We know that same-sex attracted young people are less likely to use condoms and more likely to be sexually active at an earlier age, contract an STI, and if they're at risk of unintended pregnancy, to be more at risk of unintended pregnancy. We know that there are strong links between homophobic and transphobic abuse, excessive drug use, self-harm and suicide attempts. And we know that there are multiple intersections with disability, indigenous status, culturally and linguistically diverse background, and people living in rural and remote areas. We know that a positive interaction of that young person with a healthcare practitioner at that stage of adolescence, when perhaps it's the first time that they're seeing a healthcare provider on their own, apart from their parents, there's very many different situations. That is absolutely crucial. That one misstep, and we know it, it can actually mean that their ongoing, you know, communication, ongoing interaction with the health system, whether it's for specialised services or everyday services for a cold, for whatever, can be very off-putting and can have a very significant impact. We need that positive interaction to foster resilience and well-being, as well as that ongoing healthcare engagement. And we know, unfortunately, that negative experiences are commonly reported. And we know that marginalised young people perceive and experience multiple forms of discrimination in the health system. And the excellent work by Melissa Kang, Fiona Robards, the Access 3 study, they have found that the participants in that study, they've certainly expressed ambivalence, and sometimes that's at best, about their health care journeys, but not always. We know that sexual and gender diverse young people experience more barriers than other young people, and those obstacles to care include real concerns about confidentiality, access and costs, common to all, of course, but also health literacy, assumptions about heterosexuality, and, of course, professional discomfort. So we know, I mean, there can be extremes. So with healthcare providers, being transphobic, there's stigma, there's prejudice, there's discrimination, there can sometimes even be abuse. But I will say that most doctors are coming from a good place. We're conscientious. We want to do the best by our patients, but actually what Rob pointed out before is that we often lack that professional knowledge and skills, and we feel uncomfortable with that, about owning up to that sometimes. And I think you're right, you pointed out the ever-changing labels. I think it can be quite a thing. I know when we changed our practice, we now run a cervical screening program for anyone with a cervix, and we had to bring all of the organisation along with us, all of the administration staff, the doctors, the nurses, and it was challenging for them to take on new language. But we needed to make sure that if we were running this service that everyone received had a positive interaction with our service. So there is that lack of knowledge and skills, and also just a lack of resources, lack of referral networks. What do I do with this information? I don't know where to refer to. So what do young people want services to look like? Well, they want them to be accessible, affordable and flexible. They want them to be non-judgmental and confidential, with care by knowledgeable and trained staff, up-to-date evidence-based practice, which allows young people to actually engage in their decision-making. They want culturally safe and inclusive, comfortable and friendly services. They also want young people to be involved, participating meaningfully in service planning and evaluation and review. And they want us to be able to recognise those multiple vulnerabilities and ensure that we're providing coordinated services with referral pathways and navigation supports, whether that's explicit or, again, more implicit. And they want inclusive systems that use technology. So let's see how we're doing. So what I thought I'd do is just look at it from different levels. At the top level here, high-level health sector responses. We know the World Health Organization, we know that there was a big report that came out from the Lancet in combination with the Guttmacher Institute in the US. These are putting frameworks, sexual and reproductive health and rights frameworks, and they recognize that youth-friendly sexual and reproductive health care acknowledges a young person's right to, I have to read this, my colours were good on the computer, maybe not so good here, pleasurable and safe sexual experiences, free of coercion, discrimination and violence. But if we look to Australia, I have to say, we have made some very positive strides, and we have to take our hats off to the Royal Australian College of Physicians, who in 2015 put out their position statement, which advocated for GLBT inclusive practice at all government-funded health and human services. And we all know that in these past few weeks where there have been some kickbacks and the health minister has been asked to provide a review, or that he wants a review into adolescent transgender services, the Royal College of Australian College of Physicians has actually been very vocal, and perhaps that wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. So we need policy frameworks, as I say, so let's have a look at those. So we do have frameworks to improve health service delivery for LGBTIQ people overall, and of course that trickles down to include young people as well. But we've also got youth health frameworks which recognise the vulnerability of this population group. And just to be inclusive of New Zealand, I know that in New Zealand there's a proposed New Zealand mental health care framework which includes the need to reduce stigma and enhance young people's safety. So, and we all, I'm sure we're all aware of the Australian Standards of Care of Treatment Guidelines for trans and gender diverse children and adolescents, which was, it was a landmark really. This was published in the Medical Journal of Australia, previously a very conservative, you know, publication, but of course there has been some kickback about it. So what about if we go down a layer to actually look at medical school training, nursing training, midwifery training? So there has been a change. It's not embedded across the country. I'm not sure you'd get the same sort of training at Notre Dame University in Sydney as you would in Sydney Medical School, but now it's absolutely embedded within medical school training. I actually teach sex and ethics, which very much focuses on diversity, and it cuts across the curriculum. We know that it's being included or gradually creeping into nursing and midwifery training. And we know there's increasing numbers of GP resources for accredited training. We all need accreditation. And family planning, of course, runs lots of excellent training courses around inclusivity and diversity. And the National LGBTI Health Alliance, of course, can provide training for GPs to PHNs, who are certainly realising that this is a gap and this needs to be filled. And I have to say, I have to take it out to this. So this is a cover-up of the ONG, the Royal Australian College, Australasian College of Obstetrics and Gynaecologists. They devoted a whole thing of the, you know, a whole session to LGBT issues, and I'm actually talking about contraception for trans and gender diverse people at their national conference. This would have been unheard of some time ago, and I do think that PrEP in general practice has made a huge impact. Everyone now needs to be able to talk the language, needs to be recognising diversity. So this has been a huge help, I have to say. So what about other responses? So we do know that there's increasing numbers of amounts of online information about inclusive services. So in New South Wales, the STIPU website has excellent information. There's excellent information about online STI testing services, and we've got good research to show that this is very acceptable to young people, and this one's actually a pay-it-yourself STI online testing system, which is recognising diversity, but we know that there's obviously government-funded ones as well, and this is something we certainly need to look into around that confidentiality. And we know about the dedicated gender identity service at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. But what about that meaningful youth engagement? So we know that Headspace has an excellent youth advisory group. And in fact, we're not quite as far as Ireland. So Ireland's actually got a youth LGBTI strategy, 2018 to 2020. Perhaps we should aim for that as well. But I wanted just to finish with just showing how there is actually accreditation for inclusive practice and service delivery as well. So you're probably all familiar with it, the Rainbow Tick National Accreditation Programme. It's actually administered through Rainbow Tick Victoria and practices. So general practices, other practices can actually use this as part of their accreditation against the national standards. And all of us running health services, we know, you know, sometimes it's a stick, sometimes it's a carrot, but we have to get accredited. And to have the Rainbow Tick accreditation as part of that national accreditation program is excellent indeed. It's got six standards which the service is measured against. So this is a really good thing. You've seen the other sign, which I've put up earlier, and I'll show it later. That's run by ACON, which is just a self-determining. You fill in the form yourself to say you're providing inclusive services, and then you get to put the rainbow tick on your practice. And these we know from the feedback from young people is it provides a welcoming signal to them. And they feel very reassured. We need to make sure then that we match that with their experience, of course. And just finally to come to systems. So we have made some strides with systems. So Medicare did pledge in 2013 that they were going to remove gender from their entire system. Hasn't quite got there yet, but their heart perhaps is in the right place. Obviously, we need to remind people that they can have their own Medicare card from the age of 15. We know that lots of young people don't know that. You know, I was talking to Teddy Cook before I came here, so now to actually update your gender marker in Medicare, it still does require a letter from the doctor to say that this is appropriate. We'd like to see that need to have a doctor's letter taken away altogether, but there have been some positive movements. And my health record, of course, so again, a big win there from AHHA, so the Youth Adolescent Health Society. So really they advocated on behalf of young people. So really now at the age of 14 and above, you can opt your parents into my health record rather than the other way around. So that is a big plus. And of course, we do have other practice-based software systems. We're grappling with our own at the moment, and there is sometimes a mismatch, but I think there is a global, or certainly an Australian view, that we need to actually change the systems, and even if there's a mismatch, it doesn't prevent processing of Medicare billing. So I think to sum up, there is increasing awareness at all levels of the health sector. It's not to say by any means things are sorted, but there is increasing training and professional development opportunities. There are quality improvement activities occurring across the systems, and there are, you know, systems improvements happening. But we certainly can't be complacent in any way, and I'll just leave you with that. That's an attack on LGBT, the state. So we are, just to say, actually, the other part of my work that I work in is in abortion access, and we're certainly seeing a lot of groups in medical schools springing up, how to be an effective conscientious abortion, how to be an effective conscientious objection against abortion. And we're certainly seeing quite a lot of funding coming into these groups from overseas. So I think we just can't take anything for granted. But thank you very much. Thank you.